Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Aspects, the complicated relationship between our characters. We have a love triangle that is not even quite a love triangle, because if tragedy had not happened, it may very well be that Lucy and James and Abigail might have made a go of it. And there's nothing necessarily saying that Catherine would have gotten in the way of that. It's just that there are other elements that caused further chaos, basically. Mm. And that's the way things turned out the way they did. Though, to be honest, the tragedy of Lucy's death is perhaps more in keeping with a traditional Gothic novel. I'm not saying that happy endings are anathema to a Gothic story. But even in modern stories, the idea of a love story ending in a triad is something you practically never see in mainstream literature. Even one of my favorite webcomics, Questionable Content, recently shattered everyone's favorite ship when it failed to resolve into a happy polycule. One could even say the same is true of our second trio, and in that particular case, the tragedy that happened wasn't necessarily a conflict of personalities, it was a conflict of unpredictable, the intersection of magic and neuroatypicalness.
And even that is now thrown into doubt. Up until recently, I assumed that Charlotte's condition was pre-existing. Now I am more and more considering the possibility that whatever caused her to have episodes came from an external rather than an internal source.
At this point, new readers know everything about what Krieger had to say regarding Charlotte and her, whatever her condition was, and the magic involved with that. Even people that have gone through all published works by now, and apparently many of them not even including Uncivil Outlaw, even we don't know the whole story, and so therefore it doesn't feel right to speculate about it, especially in this medium, which is meant to be accessible to people that don't know the whole story. But I have confidence in Alex eventually bringing all of this to light, and also eventually bringing together a multiple-person polyamorous couple that doesn't end in tragedy, because so far that's what we've got.
One can hope. This is something that I love about Lucy being an addition to this story, because she is that. In the definitive edition, she is such a presence that did not exist in the original text. And she accomplishes so much, as we've explored in past conversations, whether we've recorded them or not. Her presence establishes an unspoken point of connection between the Weirwood trio and the Versteck trio. She also fleshes out James and Abigail by showing what kind of a personality resonates with each of them. They both respond to characteristics of Lucy, but they're not necessarily the exact same characteristics, or if they are, they're understood through different lenses, which is what makes her a good midpoint of the two extremes that James and Abigail embody. Her absence creates a gap that becomes a defining part of the journey that James and Abigail go on, at least in terms of their relationship. But what I find most admirable about this character is that for someone who could be shallow if they were handled poorly, in that they are very clearly meant to be there to flesh out other characters and be killed off for an emotional gut punch in a tragic denouement, But Lucy isn't shallow. She isn't just an extension of other characters and their development, and she really does come across as having her own identity. She is that mix of emotional optimism and reasoned out introspection we see in her chapters, and to be honest, I think that her presence brings into focus the darker elements of this gothic text, because with her loss, the darkness comes creeping in, because, and I mentioned this to you before the podcast, Greg, that Lucy's name is associated with light. That's her point of connection with the stars that are come up so frequently, and the musical choices, I always think of the starlit sky that she took so much meaning from. And the loss of that light is a very gothic feeling of emotional melodrama that still gets to you because it's balanced with the human touches of Alex's writing and the interaction between his characters. So I am immensely thankful for Lucy's presence, as tragically short-lived as it is in this text.
As someone that was trying to look up the meaning of people's names back when we were discussing Krieger and Charlotte and Greta, I feel humbled by the fact that you twig to the fact that Lucy is based on the Latin for light or daylight. And yet I feel like I should know that, because in at least one depiction of someone from mythology taking on a different form, the demigod Lucifer took on a female form, which was often referred to as Lucy in the graphic novel The Wicked and the Divine. So I completely missed that. Thank you for catching it.
Well, the way I always see this process is that we're both sort of trying to fit together a puzzle that's in the center of the table, and we're at opposite ends with, you know, puzzle pieces scattered all around it. And it's just going to be like, there will be some that we, no matter how many times we look over the pieces, we just don't see where they fit. But for the other side, they're looking at it at a different angle, and hey, they're able to make the connection, make it fit where they need to. And the other person will go, oh, I missed that. How, like, it, why doesn't it work? And then just as they're making that, they go, oh, this fits there. And then the other one will go, wait, what? And that's what I love about this process.
Yeah, yeah. Swiftly moving on, we already mentioned that there is a Germanic feel to some of the story, and that there is also a Southern feel to some of this story, and that there are specific subgenres of Gothic that fit into each. In Germany, they have multiple subgenres. The closest in tone to Secret Rooms, I'm going to get this pronunciation wrong because I didn't look it up beforehand, more full eye, is Ritterroman, which translates as chivalry novel and tends to focus on the deeds of a soldier. Our main characters are meant to be soldiers, even prior to their intersection with Krieger and the rest of the otherworldly trio, or duo at this point, I guess. On top of that, and this is something I had no frame of reference for at all, because I never read any of the foundational works that have this subgenre qualification, is that there is something called Southern Gothic, which basically focuses on antebellum South, literally anything after the Civil War, that was often used to examine the social issues of that part of the U.S. And, you know, it gets into deeper detail later on, but we definitely can't say that racial issues are not examined by Secret Rooms. So we have a major interest. Yeah. Yeah, we grudgingly admit, because when I actually do the editing of those chapters, that's going to be the most tricky to work around, considering recent events. But once more, we digress.
When I say workaround, I obviously didn't mean that we shouldn't have talked about it. Alex so far is the one that has given the most direct feedback on how we handled the racial aspects of Secret Rooms, And as much as his approval is appreciated, it's not the same as hearing from someone that lives the problems discussed. When I put together my outlines, I do my best to try and discuss these things from an empathetic perspective, putting together everything I've learned from reading and listening to non-white people talk about these issues. But Toby and I will always be white, and nothing changes our privilege in this matter. It's my hope that our perspective helps shape the discussion and brings around people that might not consider their own privileges closely. But if there are things that I've gotten wrong or hadn't considered along the way, then all I can hope to do is learn from that and do a better job next time. That next time coming pretty soon, as the Cartographer's Handbook and Arlington are coming up fast behind Tiger's Eye.
So I very much like the intersection of two different subgenres contributing to a greater whole, which is something that, again, the definitive edition makes more possible because it makes more of a character out of the other members of Weirwood, both on James and Abigail's level, but also the adult characters in the form of Catherine Holloway and Dr. Potts, and even...
As we were having this discussion, both Toby and I realized that we were not sure where Nathan fell on this scale, as his age had never been made an issue of in the text that we could remember. But on review, given that the term man is used to refer to him at one point, and he had the title of stagehand and groundskeeper, it's probably more likely to say that Nathan is definitely older than James and Abigail, and likely a full adult. Not that it matters too much, it's just that at the time, we went on about it a bit in regards to looking it up. So this is just me cleaning up that mess. In general, his age doesn't affect his relationship to the trio at all. It's just about how his race affects the responses of others at Weirwood. One additional thing that we touched on very lightly in the first half of the episode is that just as the House of Verstekt is a character in its own right in addition to the stage of the final act, the extra chapters makes Weirwood also a character in the story, and therefore a potential symbol of the meshing of these two subgenres.
So yeah, combination of different subgenres, I'm down with that, and just like Let Them Go, Alex ends up subverting a number of some of these traditional components to good effect, I think. Bandits are often a component of previous various versions of Gothic genre and subgenre, and in the form of Carl and Virgil, they end up becoming big goddamn heroes, which I think we're all enormous fans of.
Absolutely. Carl and Virgil end up being essentially a fan favorite emergent of the story, and it's so nice, especially when you consider the context that we are suggesting newcomers experience with New Century, is that if this is your second story and Let Them Go is the only story you've experienced prior to this, there hasn't been an example yet of people who initially seem maybe shitty as a sort of like too excessive. People who initially seem like they will cause harm to you, really, at least consciously. Our only other example within Let Them Go was Dawson. We've talked about how there is a humanity there that is tapped into, but he is, at the end of the day, a bit of an ass, to just kind of wrap that up succinctly. But what's lovely about Carl and Virgil, and it's such an odd adjective to use with them, but we do love them, so i.e. they are lovely. We are, to some extent, with Abigail on our first run through, especially if we've gone through everything with Dawson before this, and we think, can we just not take on any assholes? Like, it just ends badly. And then to have it be, oh, wow, these bandits who were going to kill us and rob us were given a chance, and they showed that they were capable of change, or at least enough change that they could make a positive difference. That's so good to have after Let Them Go, because like the ultimate outcome of that story is very much of one person making it on their own, and that is triumphant. But I think that Secret Rooms represents the perfect evolution from that, which is that there will and must be cooperation and expansion of the ranks of allies, even if it means making some unlikely ones.
On top of that, when you take it overall into consideration, the fact that things turned out as well as they did is honestly a little bit astonishing. I mean, we've already got, and I won't dive too deeply into this, we've already got a lot of examples of people that will not do the right thing when there's far less on the line and far less personal consequence to them in the real world. But Frank and Annie shot two of their friends.
Yeah.
And then offered the hand of friendship to them. It may very well be that they were desperate enough to give it a try, considering what they had already lost. But it would be very understandable of them to actually take personal affront to having two people that could very well have been close friends of theirs shot dead, and then being offered the hand of friendship by the very same people that killed them. The idea of two people willing to take responsibility for their actions in this case being trying to waylay people and kill them for their stuff, and then actually accepting the hand of friendship in complete sincerity, that almost feels more unreal than we could imagine in our world right now. But it's also putting something out. It's the kind of thing that we want to see. It's yeah, what almost it's makes this, it's hopeful. It's what makes this fantasy and fiction rather than reality. And it's the kind of thing that we would want to see.
I think that there is some truth at the very least. You can't make these generalizations, obviously, but I think that there is something that you can understand is that a lot of the time, crime in our... We live in a society, Greg.
Get crime... Joaquin Phoenix out of the goddamn room.
Yeah. With crime... So much of the time it comes down to a lack of opportunity or resources, or at the very least, that is something that does contribute to it. And you really do get the impression that that's what it comes down to Carl and Virgil, is that they are surviving. They're trying to do, for what makes sense to them, the best thing they can do to get the best stuff for them and those close to them, their wives, for instance. And when Annie makes a compelling argument for why the best thing for them is to actually lay down their arms and come with them, they decide that, you know, it sounds too good to be true, but if it is true, hell, it sounds like kind of a decent deal. And they are given the opportunity for that.
This is a public services analogy.
Yeah.
Like, instead of being Batman and just breaking their jaws, she's literally like, no. If you come with us, you'll get the equivalent of welfare and, you know, the ability to support yourselves without resorting to being merciless killers or anything like that. And exactly. That's the kind of thing that government programs are supposed to do and fail so often because most of our society is focused on the punishment rather than actually fixing the problem.
Exactly. And it is very good to be able to see an example of this. Yes, there is a lot of, you know, nudging things so that it can be the most sort of vindicating thing in the world when Carl rears up like a goddamn hero. But at the same time, doesn't it feel like something that maybe could happen? Not all the time, but as Annie says, it's because sometimes it does happen. And that's why I think Carl and Virgil become these fan favorites, is because they are the sort of best case outcome of something that is worth doing.
this belief system, this thing that Alex wants to put back out into the world, it doesn't stay merely in this story either. Princess Thieves is a long way away, but it just occurred to me that there's some of that in there as well, even if it's not coming from an actual official government representative. So we'll get to talk about that eventually. That's going to be an interesting time.
Mm.
All right, more elements of the Gothic subverted.
In Let Them Go, we suggested that Aunt Cleo was a subversion of the archetype of the jealous or spiteful older woman, a la Miss Havisham from Great Expectations. In this story, we have a plethora of adult women that are a positive influence on the story as friends or teachers to our protagonists, although no crones this time around.
Annie, Catherine, you pointed out Greta to an extent, although we honestly don't know enough about Greta. She is more or less a non-entity aside from her being the possessor of power.
Mm.
They are sources of power and wisdom. We have more female mentors, I feel, over the course of all of New Century than I see in most other fiction, whether science fiction or fantasy fiction. It keeps coming up that the female voices are often the ones to set our heroes on the right track. It's not simply a Gothic subversion or anything like that, but if Gothic stories written by men tend to have an older woman that is bitter or spiteful or jealous or whatever it is, then having that trope turned on its head for the purposes of these stories is a welcome change.
Absolutely. And you've got to imagine that if we're going to get wisdom that will help our protagonists, our heroes, to enact better change, that maybe there's been enough older men who have imparted their wisdom to people who have imparted their change. Maybe it would be best if there is actually some wisdom gained from these older women and their lives and their experiences.
51%, folks.
As you keep pointing out, the old world is primarily old white men deciding how things should be. Now we're going to change that around, hopefully to the betterment of all humanity. But we've got some stumbling blocks to overcome in the meantime, because those old white men won't shut up.
I'm sorry, did you say stumbling blocks or stumbling bucks?
I said stumbling blocks, but I prefer your interpretation.
I knew what you said.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw my opportunity and I took it, Greg.
You're the wit sniper here of the two of us.
I'll call myself a sniper if it means that, you know, one of my eight rounds that I fire off hits.
Okay, fair enough. just fill the air with lead and eventually you'll hit the target.
First try.
Yeah, first try every time.
Joking aside, when I brought the subject of the old world giving way to a better one in terms of New Century, it just makes me feel tired all over, thinking about how old white men are still calling the shots now. I DM'd Toby Wednesday morning that I hoped when I woke up, we would be celebrating the re-election of Hillary Clinton, or even some other more progressive leader as president, and reflecting on that weird story we heard, where Drumpf was addressing an audience back in 2015, and then abruptly disappeared into an orange portal that appeared next to him, and then engulfed him and closed before anyone else could respond. I would give anything for leaders on the caliber of the ones presented in New Century, the women especially.
Predatory male. We have one. He's a complete dimwit and fails to achieve anything he wants based on what he does, and we're happy that Buck is, we hope, unceremoniously shuffled off somewhere else after this sequence of events.
Mm.
And while Krieger is mysterious and is revealed at the very end, you know, not completely lily white, point is that he is, there is no one here that is presented in a Xanatos-like way. where they are the puppet master that is pulling strings and making themselves either seem like they were harmless when in fact they were structuring the downfall of our heroes, or even that they were completely mustache-twirlingly evil. But you bring out a parallel between Krieger and Dracula.
Yes, well, I did find it interesting that you said that there isn't anyone pulling strings, and I would agree that it's not necessarily with malicious intent, but I think that Krieger is definitely planting some seeds here in this story. But the parallel between him and Dracula, I arrived at that not because of their personality or their actions. I don't think Krieger is biting Greta's neck between scenes in this. The reason I make that parallel is because he is the older man who allows guests into his old stately home, and themes, you know, for a time seem not too bad, maybe a little unusual at first, but then later on their true otherworldly nature comes into the light, and I think that's very much the original story of Bram Stoker's Dracula, and the character whose name I'm blanking on, who is the initial guest in his home in the first...
Oh, Jonathan Harker.
That's it.
Yeah, you forgot last time, too. It's okay.
I forget that I'm speaking to the editor of all my mistakes. This is every anxiety person's worst nightmare. Someone who has read over your words and knows everything. No.
All of your secrets, Toby.
Oh, no. You know how often I use absolutely as a space filler.
As has been established, I'm always more concretely aware of the words that I repeat using. It's fine. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a parallel that I'm not exactly sure what the implications of it are. As I say, Krieger is very different to Dracula. He is not, at least for the time being, because like Greta, he is somewhat of an enigma. I do not think that he is an embodiment of old world aristocracy or that's sort of preying on the weak. There's nothing of that going on. But I do think that his presence does contribute to the feelings of this as a Gothic text, because that sort of far off silhouette of someone who you see through the window as you approach their old home and they let you in. Everyone always talks about vampires needing to be invited in, but they don't really think about the moments when a vampire will invite you in. There is that uncertainty, and they will be perfectly charming and seem like a very acquiescent host that will say, oh yes, absolutely, we would love for you to do these things. But then the closer you come to finding out truth, the more they might put you at a distance. As soon as he hears that Annie is saying, well, we might need reunified troops to come here, he has a, oh, is that so? You could read this and maybe make the conclusion, this guy's a vampire. We've had werewolves, he's going to be our first vampire. And I'm not going to say anything to you, reader. If that's your theory right now, you hold it. It may be true. I'm not saying a word. Yeah, it's something that I noticed, and I like all the ways that he isn't like Dracula for just as much as all the reasons that he resembles Dracula's status in his story.
You know, Alex did mention at one point that he was very interested in doing a Dracula narrative. Pin that to the wall.
I'll clear some space. Hold on.
We are not going to further discuss the character of Krieger, as his mysterious origins are not something that is going to even begin to have light shed on it, or Lucy shed on it, or whatever, for a very long time. But let us bring it back to our main characters. Much like when I started looking at the character of Rebecca in Let Them Go, it actually took me until the edit to finally see the possibility that she, in fact, was a Byronic hero in terms of what she was attempting to accomplish and the role that she was playing in the story. I think that something similar could be said about Abigail, because she is always trying to push the needle a little bit in terms of trying to find out exactly what's going on, getting more freedom over her own life. That's pretty much her primary character arc through this story. Willing to, you know, test the boundaries over what is permissible, or even try to do things without being given explicit permission to do so. And on top of that, the one who is trying to maintain the established order rather than trying to suggest, hey, maybe just because this is how things are as decreed by the ones in charge, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily a good idea. That's James's role. And he is more of a supporting character to Abigail's Byronic person that goes out and does things character. So that's a subversion that I can particularly appreciate.
I'm not trying to suggest that James is not a protagonist, mind. Just that he is occupying a space that is different from Abigail's more Byronic nature, and very different from the role that a man usually plays in Gothic stories. At the end of the day, though, these tropes are just guidelines, familiar patterns. I'm not saying that Secret Rooms has to follow any given set of tropes, Gothic or not. We're just seeing what patterns do or don't seem to fit if we look at it from a Gothic perspective.
Obviously, those characterizations get far more complicated as the world opens up, and we finally get to see them interact with more characters in Steamheart. But based on this story alone, it's a nice reversal of the traditional hero being the one that does the active things and woman being the subject that is acted on. We don't even know for certain, because it isn't explicitly stated anywhere in the text, if Abigail is even virginal, like the women in Gothic narratives so often are. Even the original story doesn't make clear if anything actually sexual happens between the two of them, and we aren't going to get to find out the truth about any of that for a very long time. It's not important. The important thing is, these are our heroes. They get shit done. Hooray for them.
Not to mention that a male and female pairing should never be entirely defined on what they mean to each other sexually. Honestly, the only reason that is of interest in Secret Rooms is that with this new information of their past, we do know that there is some potential romantic energy to be explored. But I bring it up because I didn't want people to get the wrong idea. Old Byronic tropes are not necessarily good ones to follow, so I'm just as happy when they are not.
Absolutely. And James's support status is absolutely kind of emphasized by his profession as a doctor. If he's a healer, he's a support class in this particular dynamic. I think I've heard in the main School of Movies podcast, Sharon has talked about the character type of the Lancer, which is a term that I first learned about through its repeatedly coming up and then getting its own episode on the Spectacular series on YouTube, Trope Talks, which you should definitely check over on Overly Sarcastic Productions. They just put out an episode on dragons. It's great. Yeah, I would say that to some extent that Abigail would probably see herself as a Lancer, but then, and at the beginning, she sort of occupies that role, especially when Annie is making the decisions and she's saying, "No, what are you doing? You should kill them." Like, "Don't do this, Kakarot." Like, that sort of like feeling. "You're too weak and merciful." But she looks like she may occupy that role, and then she's given leadership, and it's one of those moments where the person who sees themselves as a Lancer has to kind of slowly either realize that there are things about themselves that they need to change, or maybe they aren't the version of themselves they thought they were, and that they actually are, like, they want to have more freedom to make the decisions for themselves. And I don't think it's giving too much away to say that as things go on and Abigail goes further along her journey and gets to see what comes of it, she starts to question if she's using her freedom and agency responsibly. And it's always a thing that I find Abigail one of the most endearing characters of this whole series, because she gets shit done. She knows what she believes is right and what she believes is wrong. And while she will occasionally second guess herself, she'll never second guess what she believes is right. And yeah, or at least...
Never second guess what she believes is right in this book.
In this book. In this book, yes. So Abigail is a lot of things, and that's why I love the dynamic here, because I think that Abigail is a lot more flexible as a character than James is. James is a lot more rigid, and not entirely. As we've established, James wants to sort of put himself out there. He's not staying where things are comfortable. He will venture forth. He will shake other people by the hand. But he is absolutely someone who works with what is known. And I think Abigail is the one who will venture forth.
One could ask if James becomes the Lancer to Abigail's hero when Annie is not around. But I feel like it's more complicated than that, particularly when the Lancer trope is most often used as part of a larger group. It's true that James does question Abby's actions, but he is a moderating influence to Annie's hothead, which is usually the behavior of a Lancer. For now, we'll leave it to one side, but I will put up links in the show notes pointing at the Lancer and five-man band tropes as gone into by Overly Sarcastic Productions.
I think it's something to discuss in further later on, particularly in Steamheart and Uncivil Outlaw, but just in brief, it may very well be that the reason why James is so fixated on working within an established order that he understands, whether it's science or the government or something else, is because his mind is so much chaos the rest of the time that having some sort of external focus to put on top of it is a way to help him out with his own issues. Because he is a brilliant man, but even he understands that that brilliance comes at a cost. The final point that I wanted to bring us to, how does Secret Rooms work as a standalone story, but also as a beginning to the main story? Way back in the ancient days, when I was just having conversations with Alex,
that time being 1 year previous,
my initial assertion was that Secret Room suffered from Iron Man 2 syndrome, in that it was setting up so much of the rest of the world that it made it difficult to keep a coherent narrative of its own that was able to stand by itself. That feels like a very naive reading of it. As one of the things I wrote to you initially, this is to New Century what Iron Man is to the MCU. Not a finished arc in and of itself, but the beginning to something new. Laying out a new order not just for the readers, but for the characters as well. At the beginning, Abigail and James are basically stuck in a rut, following the same patterns, living in the same world, stasis. Annie comes along like Nick Fury, brings them into the bigger universe. They have to experience it and understand just how complicated things are, even more than Annie and Frank themselves understand. They have to be challenged in how they react to each other. But all of these interactions don't have resolution any more than Tony himself was fully realized at the end of Iron Man. They now have power. They hold the starlit eyes like Tony has his arc reactor, which powers his suit. And their original strengths are now diminished as they deal with a new normal for each other and themselves. And that's what makes this story strong on its own, but makes it stronger as a proper beginning to this narrative arc.
I completely agree. And to add to that, something which occurred to me as you were speaking, would that make Let Them Go Captain Marvel?
Considering that Sharon is all but Carol Danvers in name, I think she would appreciate that analogy.
Yeah, yeah. You'll hear no argument from me on that.
And, you know, let's face it, from a certain narrative construction, she is the first hero to face the threat. She goes and has her own adventures completely apart from any of the other main characters and comes back to participate in the efforts of a greater whole much later in the story. So... Mm-hmm.
And was kind of introduced later on after the series already kind of had its beginning, but kind of gives us a little story of someone who comes into their own and breaks free from a lot of the shackles of things that other people, and specifically male figures, have put on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I like this. I'm going with this. So... At first, I was, having a very knee-jerk reaction to your sort of assessment when we were talking about this before the show that, you know, Secret Rooms becomes a perfect story to be act as the actual beginning of New Century, because I was thinking, oh, Let Them Go is a perfect beginning to New Century. We spent half a dozen episodes talking about that. Mm-hmm. But no, it's on reflection, I think I really do agree that if Let Them Go shows us how the world of New Century came to be, Secret Rooms is where we actually get to see what the world of New Century is. It takes its time to show what the ongoing problems of this world are, what its setting is, and who some of the key characters are. And by about halfway through, you're in the full swing of things. Like I said earlier, you feel like you know what New Century is about. And then that last act comes and says, there is so much more to see. And that's New Century, that right there. It starts out as this look at a Western in an alternate 19th century, and then expands into all kinds of fantasy as we explore other worlds and the creatures and people who come from there. So I still think that Let Them Go is a great start of New Century, but I will... definitely agree that, if this makes sense, that Secret Rooms is where New Century kind of begins.
Mm. Yeah. I'm never going to say that Cartographer's Handbook is a bad book, but it is doing something very different narratively. And I don't necessarily know if this is an accurate relationship, an accurate metaphor to use, but in some ways it feels like The Cartographer's Handbook suffers from the perspective of being like the Silmarillion was to Lord of the Rings.
Mm. Before Lord of the Rings actually existed in this analogy.
Yeah, exactly. So it gives us a lot of foundational stuff, but the rest of the story is in vignettes. And obviously, immediately after this, we'll get our own chance to begin to appreciate the Cartographer's Handbook for what it is, and maybe our feelings on the subject will change as a result of that.
I
enjoyed World War Z just fine when it originally came out, but World War Z is a standalone book, and Cartographer's Handbook has to be taken in relationship to all the other books of the series. So...
I would agree.
Well, it will be interesting to see how that all shakes out in the wash.
I would say it is the codex to Secret Rooms' Mass Effect 1.
Yeah, exactly. This is all the codex entries. Yeah, yeah. I can dig in it.
As people on the Discord may be aware, I decided in response to current events to skip over the Cartographer's Handbook in favor of Tiger's Eye. The events of the election are still playing out, and while I hope that the current tide is a positive indication of how things will turn out, it's not over till the loofah-faced shit-given is out of the White House, and not even then, considering the work ahead of us, to fix everything further broken in the last 4 years. In 3 months' time, I hope to be in a better place mentally to return to the handbook, and the next in the series, Arlington.
And now for something completely different.
I don't have a great love for Lovecraft. That's just the way the words ended up, okay?
You can't craft a loss of love for Lovecraft.
You can't have Lovecraft without love. No, I don't even know how that works. Moving swiftly along. I have never actually read any of the books that H.P. Lovecraft wrote. I am primarily familiar with his work through tertiary context, through things that other people have made as a result of reading his books. And his books, of course, were apparently heavily influenced by Edgar Allan Poe, in spite of them having a very different supernatural cosmic flavor to them, as opposed to traditional supernatural stuff, which people have been drawing on from the dawn of time, so to speak. But because of that first poem, it meant that I had to go back and actually think about what potential Lovecraftian influences there were in Secret Rooms. And in spite of the fact that they run only very lightly over the top of that one mention of the Devourer of Time, and given how I picked up on that one mention of first contact in Krieger's journal, I have to wonder if the two are related. But we are not lucky to find out the truth of that until much farther down the road. The actual elements of Secret Rooms could very well be said to dovetail with a lot of the narrative elements in an H.P. Lovecraft novel. One of the first similarities is that it introduces ideas and events that cannot be fully explained by science. And that's important because the setting of this world really establishes science and reason at this point being a major component, where the supernatural held far more sway, particularly in regards to Gothic novels in general. So it has to marry the two ideas together, with its primary proponent being James Penrose himself, and then say, literally, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your science books, James Penrose.
It's the sort of thing that feels difficult because there's already so many genres at play in Secret Rooms. When I first read the original edition, I wasn't quite sure how to class it, but as time has gone on and I feel like it's become a sort of more reforged and re-strengthened version of itself with the definitive edition, its genre comes into focus. And so the Lovecraftian elements are there, but to me it always felt a bit more like elements rather than necessarily, you know,
direct like parallels.
Direct parallels, exactly. But there is definitely, I think, one key area where the sort of thematic focus does overlap, and that's in a feeling of powerlessness or the control of your world being impossible or being taken away from you, because so much of this is about your world, like the foundation of your world changing from the Wendigos upheaving all of civilization to Abigail's specific circumstances where her parents made a life-changing decision for her, and as did Catherine when she was recruited into the cartographers. And also, when Lucy leaves, it's something that Abigail can't really control. It's Lucy's decision, and she just, all she can decide is whether she will make peace with letting her go or sort of not go quietly into the night, as it were. And there's so many elements of control being taken away from these characters, and I think that, you know, there may not always be giant squids involved, but that is nevertheless something that makes you feel small and powerless in a world that is quite literally trying to swallow you up through its many-teethed denizens. And
well, but the important thing to remember here is that the idea of chaos existing in the natural world is not a new one. It's that's something that exists even in drama or movies or books that have no supernatural elements at all. You know, it's one of the things that Alex has mentioned before and loves to bring up as being an important talking point, where Patton Oswalt is talking about how sickness took his wife away from him and how her favorite quote, which he has taken to heart, was,
"It's chaos, be kind."
So having a lack of control over your own world, that's definitely not specifically a Lovecraftian element. It's just in this particular case, the lack of control comes from something that, you know, if the difference between a child not being able to understand why they can't have things the way they are is different from an adult understanding that things or some things are simply beyond their control, is different still from realizing that parallel worlds exist and how.
Yeah, I will admit they're on a different level, yeah, somewhat.
Yeah, and that is definitely a major component of Lovecraft, is the uncontrollable force that threatens civilization all the time, and that even if you rally arms against it, it can never be fully quelled. That's what some of the elements of the Elder Gods represent, is the thing beyond our comprehension that wishes us ill, even if it is not directly malicious, if it is harmful merely by existing. And that is almost the portals themselves. They apparently did harm just by them coming into existence. Even without the presence of something like Cthulhu or Nyarlathotep or the Yellow King, those particular characters that come to play in a lot of different Lovecraft and Lovecraft derivative works, merely something that has not been previously accounted for and there is no infrastructure for dealing with, can cause enormous chaos to even a world that generally has good order for dealing with these kinds of things. Cough, cough, coronavirus.
One could ask what the difference is between believing in a god or gods and believing that Cthulhu exists. After all, mythology is full of gods causing chaos just because they want to as well. It's a way of explaining tragedy or chaos that could not yet be explained by science. But mythology also humanizes these forces, believing that we can impose some order on it by appealing to it as a human, or believing, as so many do, that God has a plan. And humans accept this, whether or not it actually works in their favor or not. Cthulhu is to humans more like what a human is to an ant.
What is this?
An ant.
Ant?
So much gets shipped up from Earth on commercial transports, it's hard to keep them out.
Yeah, I have just picked it up on the tip of my glove. If I put it down again, and it asks another ant, what was that? How would it explain? There are things in the universe billions of years older than either of our races. They are vast, timeless. And if they are aware of us at all, it is as little more than ants. And we have as much chance of communicating with them as an ant has with us.
We know. We've tried.
And we've learned that we can either stay out from underfoot or be stepped on.
Elements of fictional worlds often result in taking something that either does exist or could exist and putting our characters up against it and seeing what shakes out as a result. It's just that in this particular case, it requires either a surrendering of the idea that you cannot fully understand it or control it, or it requires the idea that you need to learn as much about something as you can and suffer consequences along the way, that you can't simply muscle your way through something. As Lindsay Ellis might put it, that's the difference between using a Macintosh computer to hack into an alien warship and shutting it down so you can fire a missile past its shields, and the thing that kills aliens is something that they're not prepared for either, human disease. So yeah,
I quite like the sort of solution that is presented in the finale of this book, of if there is this power, this knowledge, this thing that will put people in closer contact with these distant worlds, these doorways that can bring about worldwide catastrophe, that it's something that could destroy someone, that in typical Lovecraftian fashion, gazing at these Lovecraftian elements will drive someone to madness, and it is a destructive process. But what I think is a very elegant solution to how events play out is that if just James or just Abigail had faced the orb alone, they may have been destroyed by it. They may have gone entirely blind and not been able to escape the house. But it's because they faced it together. They share the knowledge. They share this connection to this whole other infinite worlds and infinite possibilities that could swallow them up if they were to face it alone.
Rather like how the Guardians came together in order to contain the power gem.
But together...
They share the consequences as well.
Exactly. They share the consequences. They don't get out unscathed. They come out of it and they are changed. But everything about how that finale goes down is about them getting each other through it. There's not just one moment for each character. There's multiple occasions where it feels like, okay, James would be dead right now if not for Abigail. Okay, Abigail would be dead right now if not for James. It just keeps happening. And it establishes that this is an ongoing thing, that the horrors, both immediate and in front of you, as is a burning house or a Wendigo bursting through the doors, and cosmological and far faster than you can comprehend, can be faced and endured together.
That's very MCU right there.
We're the Avengers. We can bust arms dealers all the live long day, but that up there, that's the end game. How are you guys planning on beating that?
Together.
We'll lose.
And we'll do that together, too.
That covers most of the Lovecraftian elements so far, pretty succinctly. The one that you weren't sure about, and again, I don't have first-hand knowledge of this. I pretty much have the information that is provided to me by the Wikipedia, as well as certain other derivative works. Part of the reason why Lovecraft is so problematic these days is his treatment of non-Anglo-Saxon races and cultures in his various works.
Racism!
Oh god, this box has racism in it! Get it out!
No! It's even worse than the giant squid.
You know what? No. I think it's common enough knowledge about what kind of person Lovecraft was. And if you really want to know more, you can look it up, although I would recommend that you not. Instead, I suggest you either read Lovecraft Country by Matt Huff, or watch the HBO series based on same, especially since that was made by Black creators. It's not completely without its own issues, but it is a worthwhile story and world to explore. Not to mention that supporting them would be supporting similar stories in future. But we're not going to end on an ugly note, because I get into a moment, This should be a time of celebration.
Thanks once again for joining me down this particular Windor as we finally close the book, so to speak, on Secret Rooms.
You had that planned.
I wish I could say that I have everything planned, but sometimes, as you say, the puzzle piece merely slots into place.
And thank you, dear listeners, for following us down this winding trail to the end of Book 2. This has been a rough year for everyone. A rough 4 years for everyone. And this week has been especially difficult. After the election in 2016, I was walking around in a daze. Not perplexed by the willingness of people to vote someone like Trump into office, but by the fact that they succeeded. And the last 4 years have taken a toll on all of us, never mind those that this administration targeted to suffer. So when Tuesday rolled around, and it didn't seem like there was an immediate repudiation of this awful man and his awful administration, well, I won't say I was surprised then either, because Trump has emboldened people like him to be more open about their backwards beliefs. I held out a glimmer of hope that maybe he had gone too far, and it made me turtle up to find that dashed. But hope did not die, because in spite of all those that rose up in opposition, we who believe in a better world rose up in greater numbers to respond. In the past 4 years, as things got worse, we kept fighting back, and most importantly, we kept hope alive. To borrow from a piece of fiction, hope is real. Hope is what gives us the courage to take on our greatest challenges, to move forward together. Hope is not up for debate. That is the cornerstone of New Century. There's a lot of work to be done, I know that. But in this one moment, we have strengthened the flame of hope to believe that we can fix the broken parts of our world. We have come together to say in the face of this man that is a representation of everything that is wrong and told him no. And we will keep doing hard work to tell him and all those like him, no, you move.
Today, at the edge of our hope, at the end of our time, we have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today, there's not a man nor woman in here that shall stand alone. Not today. Today we face the monsters that are at our door and bring the fight to them. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
It's probably just as well that I chose to set aside the Cartographer's Handbook down the road, though, because the alternative can be a monument to that hope. Next week, we start in on Tiger's Eye. We have a brand new opening, new ideas to consider, a whole new world to explore. And to bring a coda to the excitement we feel for having gotten here, let me close out with one of the most fun songs of the oeuvre of one Gavin Dunn, and one that likely needs no introduction to this audience.
Stick to on the streets paranoid. So lock your windows and pray your jewels are stolen away. Keshita's coming to play with your things, relieving you of your purse. Throughout the guild is dispersed, and while you crib and you curse, we will sing.
Is recording. I will say on the record that Sarah has been very patient while I've been yelling at my laptop for the last half hour. So thank you, Sarah. And it is one of those things that there's a lot of people who will associate, spacefaring, ancient civilization conspiracies with that greatest of foes, ancient Egypt.
I never expected you to drop in a Linkara reference. Well done, sir. A lot of the talking points can be gone over relatively quickly so that we can get to the actual meat of the conversation, which is talking about Gothic elements and talking about Lovecraftian elephants.
Lovecraftian elephants?
That's going in the blooper reel right there.
That's amazing. I want to see that.
The interview with...
Dumbo's a Lovecraftian elephant!
Okay, I don't even know where you just made that connection right there.
He can fly. Have you ever seen any other elephants do that? It defies the reasoning of our dimension and our reality, Greg.
I mean, it's still traveling a three-dimensional space. It would be more like if Dumbo was able to clip through walls and do speed runs. That would be something. That would be more like what has man wrought? What has elephant wrought? Okay, sorry, we're getting off track again, but I'm all of a sudden pondering the possibility of a character that's akin to Carpet in Aladdin and the Cloak of Levitation in Doctor Strange that is taking part in the proceedings but doesn't actually speak at all. Because they have a way of making that kind of character very endearing. It's just it's not as exciting in an audio drama because you can't see what's going on. Therefore, Alex would have to describe everything such a character would do.
I think it would require a deftness to the narration that would make you have to kind of use a short amount of words to communicate a very specific expression. And it's the sort of thing that works wonders in visual media with, a character who is silent but can communicate so much from the carpet's sort of brow that they managed to do. And with Gromit and Wallace and Gromit, just there's so many non-verbal characters who just, you love to see. And I don't think that it's impossible in New Century, especially because... if there's one thing that we can say helps having Alex be someone who has studied film so much and is bringing everything he's learned from stories and fiction and media is that he is well observed of things that work and how they work. So I have confidence that he could make it work.
I mean, and that's just assuming that he would have an interest in doing something.
Oh, yeah.
The issue that I would see being present is that some of the best moments of having not simply a non-speaking, but someone that distinctly has a personality without having a face, Gromit is at the very least a dog. He has a face, he has limbs, he can put down train track. That's part of the whole thing. Whereas with the Cloak of Levitation, they have to suggest empathy and movement and action without any of the standard accoutrement that an actor would have in terms of facial expression or even like hands. So some of the best moments that happen in that kind of media is where two other people are doing something and the Cloak of a Levitation would be just like off to one side and doing something perhaps without even Doctor Strange noticing it was happening. I mean, obviously, the cloak intercedes in a lot of what's going on, and that's how we get to know him. Excuse me. The cloak intercedes in everything that's going on, and that's how we get to know them. I don't think I would feel weird about gendering a cloak. But it's, you know, there are tools that are available in visual media that would not fit as cleverly, seamlessly into media that had to all be communicated through through text. Like, there could be music or other sound cues going on, but unless someone pointed out that this sound was associated with the non-speaking character, we wouldn't necessarily even know that there was something to see going on. So
what you almost need is a bumblebee situation of a character that is kind of using audio clips that are, you know, by themselves, maybe not necessarily like mean it much. They're just sort of segments of other things chopped together. But I think when they're supplied in the proper context, they add a lot of emotional meaning. And this is your friendly reminder that if you haven't seen Travis Knight's Bumblebee, please see Travis Knight's Bumblebee. It's so good.
It really, I was hoping that I would enjoy it as much as I did, and I did, in fact, enjoy it a great deal. I really wished that they would do some more with that, because original Transformers was pretty formative for me, and just getting to see Peter Cullen voice an Optimus Prime that actually looked like Optimus Prime just did so much good for my heart, so... We keep getting sidetracked here. Come on, it's not that complicated. All right. Other
Greg,
elements.
Greg, we would open many boxes.
It always comes back to boxes. I mean, I'm going to have to do some editing here. I don't know if I'm going to leave this confusion in, because goodness knows we already ramble far too long than we should in most of the rest
Greg,
of our episodes.
Name one instance where we got off topic in this recording.
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep that at least.
Yeah, exactly.
The extra chapters makes Weirdwood... It's okay. This is the final episode. You're... Don't have to spell or say Weirwood anymore. But just one last time for the audience.
Little bit of a side note there. Something that didn't actually come up, I think, during our conversation, and I realized during a side conversation with Alex, the reason why the shop in Let Them Go is called Havisham's is literally a reference to Miss Havisham from the Charles Dickens novel.
So, oh, God damn it.
Yeah, exactly. Goes off and has her own Avengers.
I'm going to make my own Avengers with Blackjack and Hawkins.
It's not like I ever want to give any of Alex's work short shrift. But he wants us to get to Tiger's Eye.
We want to get to Tiger's Eye.
Yeah.
Let's get to Tiger's Eye.
Exactly.
Come and see what goods I offer.
Khajiit is ready for any troublemakers.